This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll visit with Aaron Beam, former HealthSouth Chief Financial Officer. He'll talk about his conviction, incarceration, and comeback. And his book is The Ethics Playbook. We'll discuss it with Aaron Beam. Also on the show today, Tara Wicker, the East Baton Rouge councilwoman, on the controversy over the successor to Buddy Amoroso, the councilman who died in a bicycle accident 12 days ago. And we'll hear from journalist Mark Ambinder. His book is about what almost happened in 1983. He says the world almost came to grips with a nuclear catastrophe. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. And if you'd like to send an email, talk@talklouisiana.org works. Later in the hour, we'll hear from Tara Wicker, the East Baton Rouge Parish Councilwoman, who is in the middle of a dispute over who succeeds Buddy Amoroso on the council. Buddy Amoroso was killed 12 days ago in a bicycle accident. And we'll also talk with Mark Ambinder. His book is The Brink, President Reagan and the Nuclear War Scare of 1983. We start with Aaron Beam. He is a native of Bossier City, graduate of LSU, and has quite an interesting story. And it involves a rise in a major company as chief financial officer of HealthSouth, $2.7 billion accounting fraud scheme was uncovered. And as a result, the former chief financial officer, Aaron Beam, went to jail, as did others, including the notorious Richard Scrushy. But first of all, Aaron, before we get to what's happened since, and he has been out of jail now for more than a decade, how did you get involved with HealthSouth? What was the catalyst for going to work for this firm?
Well, I was actually a founder of the company. I was working for Richard Scrushy, who was one of the other founders, in a healthcare company in Houston, Texas. And our company was bought out, and Richard was approached by venture capitalists about starting his own company. And in 1984, he formed HealthSouth, and I put money into the company, and I was the first chief financial officer. So I was there from the very beginning.
And then things were going well for a while.
They went very well. We were very fortunate in that Richard was a bit of a visionary, and he saw that healthcare costs were getting so out of control, and he felt like you could lower healthcare costs by doing things outside of the acute care hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So we got into the outpatient surgery business, outpatient rehab business, rehab hospital business, and the timing was just perfect. And our basic business strategy was to align ourselves with the best orthopedic surgeons that we could. And interestingly, in Birmingham, Dr. Jim Andrews practiced at our hospital. Dr. Andrews is a graduate of LSU. He is probably the renowned orthopedic surgeon in the United States. He did Bo Jackson's hip, Troy Aikman's shoulder. He's the doctor that told the New Orleans Saints that Drew Brees could still throw the football. So he was kind of the face of the company in a lot of ways. So we had a lot of almost lucky things happen to us. And within 10 years, we were a Fortune 500 company, largest company in the state of Alabama.
And you were based in Birmingham?
In Birmingham, Alabama.
So an LSU guy's in Birmingham and doing very well. And then how did the wheels come off the wagon?
Richard Scrushy literally told everyone he wanted to be a billionaire. He on a television show said, I want to become the richest man in the state of Alabama. And he totally controlled his board of directors, and he gave himself millions of options, stock options. And as the stock started going up, he was almost a billionaire. But he overpromised Wall Street what we could do. He told the analysts we were going to earn more than we really could. And rather than reporting earnings below street expectations, he asked me and my staff to cook the books. he said, look, we'll only do it once. You know, everybody does this kind of thing. Get the numbers to where they need to be.
Well, recently we've seen stories that the president of the United States exaggerated his wealth to get in the Fortune 500 by a big margin. So what's the difference?
Well, it's dishonest. When you claim things that aren't true, it's unethical. And it's at the heart of why I do my public speaking today about ethics.
How did you fall victim to this? And by the way, Aaron has been involved with two books, the last being Ethics Playbook. It's been out a few years, but it's about his odyssey. How did you say okay when you knew you were doing the wrong thing?
You know, I think about that all the time, but I really believe Richard had created almost a cult-type environment. He was the kind of guy that you just... He made it so unpleasant to say no. Everything he did when he asked the board of directors for something, he would always open up with, don't you think we should? And when he said that, if you dare say no, I don't think we should do that, he'd literally beat you up. And he had conditioned me over the years to become a yes man. And in the heat of the battle, when he said, let's fix these numbers, I was stupid enough to do it. I didn't have the courage to stand up to him, and I got myself in a terrible mess.
Did you ever think about going to work somewhere else?
Well, not really. But within 6 months, I resigned from the company. I left the company. And the fraud went on for 7 years.
But those 6 months caused you to be vulnerable, and ultimately you were tried, convicted, and served some time in federal prison.
I actually wasn't tried. I came forward and admitted my guilt and was sentenced to 3 months in prison.
Did you have to agree to testify against others?
I did. They wanted me. 17 people came forward and said, we're guilty. Only Richard Scrisci denied knowing anything about the fraud. And the government, of course, asked me to be a witness.
All right. 877-217-5757 for Aaron Beam, who has quite a fascinating story. He is a Louisianian. I see you have your E.J. Uso College of Business Flores MBA program shirt on, and he is a graduate of the Old War School and was doing very well. Went to high school, by the way, in Bossier City with one Charles Elson Buddy Romer III, who became governor of our state. Both of you brilliant guys, but you ended up going the wrong way and had to make the long haul to come back from this, and you've done well since, but this still has to be the epic moment of your life.
No doubt about it. I mean, I was a millionaire several times over. I was highly respected, and when you go to prison, it's a very much a life-changing event. And my wife and I had some pretty dark times, but we came out okay.
Well, this Scrisci fellow, he was featured on 60 Minutes. Very charismatic man, by the way.
Oh, yeah. That's part of his charm.
And I mean this, in this case, I mean it as a compliment. Very Trumpian. But he had that kind of magnetism that got things done, but you're saying he went above the line, and ultimately he went to jail for something else, didn't he?
He did. The governor of Alabama, Siegelman, Donald Siegelman, was running for re-election, and HealthSouth, not Richard, but HealthSouth, gave the governor $500,000 as a campaign contribution. After he was re-elected, Richard was appointed to a state...
I think this was to get an initiative passed, wasn't
right,
it?
Right, a wasn't state board.
Going to, straight to him, but it was an initiative he supported.
Right.
And then Scrisci gets appointed to a board, and they basically put a governor in jail for 6 years for putting a campaign contributor on a board. Now, if that's the standard, then all 50 governors in America would be vulnerable.
Really true, and it's so ironic that Richard was found not guilty of the HealthSouth fraud
he was guilty.
Yeah, and then when he probably wasn't guilty, I think the system caught up with him. I don't think the federal government likes losing these lawsuits. The HealthSouth lawsuit was the first Sarbanes-Oxley case tried in the United States, and Richard beat it. And when they got him for bribery, they didn't let him off.
Well, Siegelman, the governor, ended up serving his time at Oakdale. He was there at the same time as Edwin Edwards.
Oh, really?
And he got out after Edwin Edwards. But Scrushy, what is he doing now?
He lives north of Houston in the Woodlands, and I'm not sure what he's doing.
Don't talk with him.
I don't. No, no, we don't talk at all.
You split the sheets a long time ago.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Aaron Beam, he's got a fascinating story, and we'll spend another segment with him. 877-217-5757 is your number, and he was the HealthSouth chief financial officer and a founder of the company. Pleaded guilty in a fraud case and served 3 months in jail. How was that experience when you're going to jail? Even if it's for a short time, it has to be a most humiliating experience.
It certainly is. It just brings you down to earth. You check in, they take all of your clothes, everything away from you except your wedding band on your finger. They give you three sets of clothes and a small locker and one folding chair and a terrible bed.
Terrible bed? Federal prison was not club fed, as
no,
they call it?
No, 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 no. That's a real myth.
Where were you?
Inside of an Air Force base at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama.
Well, Aaron Beam is now a prominent public speaker across the country telling his story, and he'll tell his with us for another segment after this quick pause on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're with Aaron Beam. He was the CFO for HealthSouth, the company that was run by Richard Scrushy, who ultimately went to federal prison on another caper involving the former governor of Alabama, Don Siegelman. And you just heard Aaron, I suspect, if you were listening earlier, say that he thought that that Scrushy was probably innocent of the crime that he went to jail for and guilty of the one he was acquitted on. But you did go to jail and agreed to testify against Scrushy. Had to be a very difficult situation when you took the stand, didn't you?
I did.
And when
did.
You're there, and I'm sure you looked at him, and he looked at you, how was that experience?
It was eerie. It really was. He was only a few feet away from me, and it's funny, when they were preparing me for the trial, they took me into the courtroom and showed me where he'd be sitting and everything, and it was really, really kind of bizarre.
And you go to jail, and even though it's only for 90 days, you said it was not a pleasant experience. How was it behind bars?
Well, the worst thing about it was the food. the budget to feed us was $3 a day. Somewhere on this Air Force base, they had a government warehouse full of canned peaches. And every morning, almost without exception, our breakfast consisted of canned peaches and grits. No eggs.
Every morning?
Yeah, almost every morning.
But I bet you lost some weight.
A little bit. But first time I got the right to call my wife, I went on and on about how bad the food was. And she said, "Aaron, you're in prison."
It shouldn't be that great, right? But a lot of times people go to prison, Edwin Edwards, Billy Cannon, Jim Brown, and they look better coming out of prison than they did going in because they slim down and they start exercising, doing all the right things.
Yeah, you don't have anything else to do.
They're not going to these high-end restaurants having creme brulee after a healthy
meal. They aren't drinking beer.
But you had serious money. How much?
My peak, I maybe was worth about $5 million.
Okay, well,
that's serious.
It's, particularly in this part of the country, and we're talking a few years ago as well. So you were a rich man.
Yeah.
So rich that I'm told you had a replica of Tiger Stadium in your backyard. Is that right?
I did. I bought 25 acres of land. It was actually in Mobile, Alabama, or close to it, and I was doing a bunch of landscaping, and I had a big open field, and I decided to put really nice grass down, and then I said, "Darn, this looks like a football field." So I ordered some goalposts, put up goalposts, and ordered the wraps for the goalposts the same as they used in Tiger Stadium at the time. And it made the news. It was quite a
thing. What happened to all that?
I had when I was found guilty or pled guilty and had to go to prison, I had to pay restitution, and I had to auction off that property in my home. So I lost it.
So how much did you have to pay the government?
Essentially everything I had. So when I got out of prison, I actually had to mow lawns for a living.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. Yeah. You became a one-man lawn service, didn't
that's
you?
Right.
And this is a guy who had $5 million.
Yeah.
And you joined the Catholic Church.
I did join the Catholic Church in 2012, and my wife is a cradle Catholic, and I'm a very different man now.
Did this put stress on your marriage?
You know, it survived. There were four other CFOs that were involved in the fraud, and all four of them, their marriages did not survive the ordeal. But we celebrated our 48th wedding anniversary recently. My wife is very important to me, and I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for her.
Well, you're not destitute, but nonetheless, you're not wealthy the way you once were.
No.
Does that bother you?
The only thing that bothers me is that it was great to be rich to the point that you could come home and the wife say, well, the air conditioning went out today. And the guy said it's going to cost $8,000 to replace it. I said, okay, I just write a check.
Mm-hmm.
So today, if I go home and my air conditioning's out, I've got a problem.
Yeah. You lived in a big house, I suspect.
Very big house.
How big was it?
About 7,000 square feet.
And how many people were living in it?
Two.
Two. Did you ever get lost in your own house,
no,
Aaron?
No, never got lost.
Aaron Beam, pride of Bossier City, Bossier City High School with right. Buddy Romer and LSU. And you had a great career, and then you get swept up in something that you obviously were guilty in, but yeah. It was charisma of Scrooge that you say was a big catalyst for you cooking the books. How did the two of you meet?
I actually answered an ad in the Houston Chronicle in Houston when he was working at a company there, and he hired me to be his controller at another company. So that's how we got started.
Do you ever feel like you were in any kind of physical danger when you went to the other side and became a witness?
I did. Richard's a pretty scary guy. I mean, he's very... I tell people if Richard and Hannibal Lecter got into a fight, Richard would win. He's scary.
No physically doubt. Intimidating?
Not size-wise and all, but just his eyes. I mean, he's just scary. Scary. It's funny. But, hard to explain.
But as far as you know, he never took any aim at his... enemies, did he, in that
way? Well, we don't know for sure. He caught his personal accountant stealing from him, embezzling, and the guy was found with a gunshot to his head. About 2 weeks later, he was dead.
Really?
Yeah. This was ruled a suicide.
This was before you met him or after?
No. This was late while he was still at Hell South.
So you were there?
I had left the company at the time, yeah.
Well,
but he had bodyguards, he had vicious dogs. When the FBI raided the Hell South building, they found closets full of automatic weapons, bizarre stuff.
Did he feel it was a necessity to be involved in politics?
Yes. He gave money to anybody that was in any level of government that might influence the company, and... both sides, but he did. He felt like that was an important thing. We had a lobbying firm in Washington that lobbied for us, that kind of stuff.
Specifically for you.
Right.
Your books are about this episode in your life, and the last, as I said, the Ethics Playbook. What lessons have you learned, maybe about what not to do, but also about what to do if you're down and out and people are counting you? The 10 count. You took a knockout punch.
Yeah.
And you're back up.
Back up. I find it very rewarding to speak to college students about ethics. When you stop and think about it, the world really functions best when there's a high level of trust. And you need to be ethical in everything you do so that there's a high level of trust. When people lose trust in their government, their company, anything, things go south pretty fast. And that's my main message, is be ethical, because in the long run, you can get ahead in the short run by cheating and being unethical, but in the long run, to succeed, you need to do it the correct way.
Do you have regrets?
Of course I have regrets, but when I got out of prison, my wife and I talked about moving to Washington State or something and getting as far away from this part of the country as we could, but I went the other way, and I've written books. I speak about it, and that helps me get over my feeling badly about what I did.
I mentioned your wife. What about the rest of your family? Were they humiliated by this?
I have a daughter who's 43 years old now. And yes, it was hard on her, but she's doing fine now.
You remain close?
Oh, yeah, very close.
So you found redemption, as they say.
I think so. Yeah. I think so.
Your personal, we're about to run out of time, but I suspect a lot of this had to do with your personal belief system.
True. I really enjoy going to Mass every Sunday. It's important to me.
Well, thank you, Aaron Beam. Congratulations on your comeback.
Okay.
And thanks
thank
for
you.
Sharing your story.
Okay.
We're back after this pause for the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing. In just a bit, we'll hear from Tara Wicker. That's the plan, the veteran councilwoman for East Baton Rouge Parish. And four Democrats have indicated that they won't vote to replace Buddy Amoroso, and that has caused a lot of controversy, because this has happened in recent vintage where a councilman died, Mike Tossan, and he was replaced by his wife, Martha Jane Tossan, who ultimately served a couple of terms on the council. And it was thought that Denise Amoroso would be appointed to succeed her husband for the remaining time before the special election. And it takes seven votes to do this. And if Tara Wicker had joined the other four Democrats, that would be the death knell for this plan. And then Governor John Bel Edwards would be assigned to appoint the successor to Amoroso. And if that were to happen, the governor, being a Democrat, would be perhaps inclined to appoint a fellow Democrat to succeed a Republican. And it's caused a lot of grief for the four councilmen and women who chose this strategy. And Tara Wicker said she would not be part of it. So it's a story that will be simmering for some time, and the next council meeting is next week on the 18th. Yesterday in the business report, there was a story on the daily report from Annie Landry saying, what exactly is the precedent for filling unexpected Metro Council vacancies? It's a question among many that has arisen following Tuesday afternoon's surprise announcement from four Democratic Metro Councilmen that they won't vote on any candidate to fill the seat of the Republican councilman Buddy Amoroso. Another question, is there any difference between filling Amoroso's seat and addressing a vacancy created by someone who moves on from the council after winning another elected post? There is some recent precedent. In 2016, a vacancy was created when former Metro councilman Denise Marcel won a seat in the Louisiana legislature. At that time, Buddy Amoroso nominated Sandy Lemoyne, a white Republican, to fill the seat in a majority African-American Democratic district. Marcel's nomination, Lamont Cole, was appointed instead. The bit of history was highlighted in an anonymous email sent to local media outlets yesterday morning. The email suggests Amoroso did not follow the tradition of honoring the wishes of the previous council member when appointing a temporary replacement. So why should the Democratic council members follow tradition in appointing Amoroso's successor? While we wait for Tara Wicker, if you'd like to join the conversation on this, 877-217-5757 or 297-5633 in Baton Rouge, and you can always send us an email at talk@talklouisiana.org. Gary Chambers, the activist who quite often is vocal on these matters, an African-American who's been on this program, was quoted in the Daily Report story as saying, "This shows Amoroso was not one who believed in the legacy tradition that all the other council members are trying to ascribe is a reason why the four council members are wrong." Those who criticize the Democrats' decision argue that the two cases are not one and the same. Matt Watson, frequent guest on this show, says having an accident out of the blue, something as shocking as Buddy's death, is vastly different than watching a council member campaign for over a year and win another seat. The council members who reportedly will abstain from voting are Shauna Banks, Lamont Cole, Erica Green, and Donna Collins-Lewis. In a press release, they gave no specific reason, just saying we will make no further comment on the matter at this time. 877-217-5757, Gaston from the Lakes. Hi, Gaston. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I was having dinner with my son and his relative to this conversation because he's such an enlightened young person. And the other last night, and we were talking about the political thing and how they discounted Obama's appointment, and there's a lot of politics going on in the Senate, in particular the turtle head guy. But he said specifically is that the politics at the federal level, it starts here in the neighborhood level. So that's, in my take, the plague right going on here, and perhaps that history you have is happening.
Well, what do you think should happen here? What's the proper resolution in your
judgment? Well, I
think
it's going to have to play out, Jim, one way or the other. If somebody's got to get the governor appointed. He's kind of a middle-of-the-road kind of Democrat, in my opinion, because he'll probably go ahead and give it to Amoroso's wife. I don't know. But I don't think Kennedy's going to run for the governorship just yet. I think he's enjoying his senatorship, my two cents. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, Gaston. I appreciate it. It's something that has divided the city, and as we know, we have a city that's already divided, and in this case, we have five African-American Democrats on the council, and we have six white Republicans on the council. And it is a case in which there's race, there's political party, all these aspects are in play, and of course, there is a geographic thing. We know that in Baton Rouge, we're quite often accused of having one city north of Florida Boulevard and another south of Florida Boulevard, and those who live on the south side rarely go, unless they go downtown, they rarely go past that to any part of North Baton Rouge. And we have a tale of two cities in one city. 877-217-5757, but Tara Wicker, and I have sent you a message on how to reach Tara, and hopefully we can get her on the line. Our producers are Becca Dill and Ali Baltazar, and they're working fervently to make that happen. But Tara Wicker, the only Democrat who's not participating in the abstention, says she plans to follow the tradition in the appointment of Amoroso's replacement and will support Denise Amoroso. "My only response is always two wrongs don't make a right," Wicker says, referring to Amoroso's 2016 recommendation for Marcel's vacant seat. "It was wrong if Buddy broke tradition, and it's still wrong for us to do it." That's from Tara Wicker, who at times through the years has not voted in line with other Democrats. Usually she does, but quite often she will do something different than her fellow Democrats. 877-217-5757. And we now have Tara Wicker on the line. And good morning to you, Tara.
Good morning. Good morning.
It's nice to hear your voice. And I've been recapping what's happened over the last few days, and the meeting is slated next week. What do you think will happen between now and then?
Well, I think between now and then, as I appreciate from what I've heard in the media, I think that there is going to be a meeting with Denise Amoroso between her and the four council members that were having conversation about abstaining from the vote. As I appreciate it, they're going to meet and have some conversation about her interest in taking Buddy's seat. I did receive a call from her on yesterday confirming that, you know, she is interested. I know that last time I spoke with her was at Buddy's funeral, and she told me that she was, you know, she was praying about it, and she was going to make a decision. You know, she hadn't made a decision, but that she was praying about it, and so she called me on yesterday and confirmed that she was going to go and would like to fill his unexpired term.
Well, what do you think of the decision by Shauna Banks, Lamont Cole, Erica Green, and Donna Collins-Lewis to abstain? And for, if you had done the same, then it would have caused a special election. What do you think about that strategy?
I think that the strategy, I clearly understand what they are, you know, the frustration in terms of what, you know, what's going on in terms of the division that's on the council. There's no secret about the split that's been existing between the Democrats and the Republicans. And unfortunately, from time to time, there, in my opinion, there's been some abuse of that power where individuals have said, we don't need your vote. And that's actually been said. And so that's been really unfortunate because that's caused sort of that frustration and that divide. I clearly get that and I understand. And I've said this before. Do I believe that our council would benefit from having a sixth African-American seat? Most definitely. And I think that that needs to happen partly because I think as a community, as a larger community, it forces us to have a conversation that we're just not having, because at that juncture, somebody's going to have to talk to the other side and persuade individuals on the other side to come over just for us to effectively move anything through the council. That would be something that's very different, very unprecedented, and we need to do that. Is this the proper vehicle, the proper time, the proper method to do that? I think that the strategy is short-sighted. I think that there needs to be a more long-term sustainable approach that allows our community to come together as opposed to divide it. So I think that the strategy needs to be more thought out.
877-217-5757. The meeting is next week. Will it be Wednesday or Thursday?
It's actually going to be Thursday at 5 p.m.
Okay, so it'll be a week from today, and we'll talk with Tara Wicker about what's happening between now and then, and why this is another issue that's caused a division, and the last thing we need in our community is more of that, because there is plenty to go around, and we'll get Tara Wicker's take. And we'd like to hear from you, 297-5633 in Baton Rouge, and talk at talklouisiana.org. We're back after this pause with more from Councilwoman Tara Wicker on Talk Louisiana. You're listening to WRKF 89.3 in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Becca Dill and Ali Baltazar are producing, and Tara Wicker is our guest. She is a member of the Metro Council, and next week, as in a week from today, the council will meet, and the big item of discussion is what to do about the seat that was vacated when Buddy Amoroso died in a bicycle accident, a crash in the St. Francisville area 12 days ago. His widow, Denise, has expressed an interest in taking over the District 8 seat and will likely be the nominated successor because Tara Wicker, our guest, did not side with four other Democrats on the council to refrain from voting. If that had happened, then Governor John Bel Edwards would have appointed the successor. 877-217-5757, Dan downtown. Hi, Dan. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hi. Yeah, Ms. Wicker, would it be consistent with Michelle Obama's maxim that when the Republicans go low, Democrats go high? Just let Amoroso's widow take the seat.
Wow. You know, that's very interesting, and I know that was a very well-taken approach by our former First Lady, and I did see that, and I thought that was definitely something that, you know, was a good example. But I would have to tell you this. My premise and my foundation for this is more along the lines of a little lady named Joan Smith, who raised me as a single mom. And from a very small girl, my mom taught me, you know, she knew that I had a desire to be in politics. And as a matter of fact, when I worked in Mayor Simpson's office as an assistant chief administrative officer, she told me, honey, she said, because I was, you know, the only woman, the only black, and all the onlys or whatever. And she said, honey, she said, no matter what, she said, you always have to stand for what's right. She said, and there's going to be times that you're going to have to stand alone, but stand alone and be okay. And know that God's got you and you do the right thing no matter what. And that's been the foundation of how I was raised. I didn't have the option to do anything otherwise. And that's just at the core of who I am. And if I ever walk away from doing that, then I've walked away from who I am as a person. I don't do the black thing. I don't do the white thing. I just do the right thing. And that's who I am.
Here's an observation from King in Mid-City saying the Democrats attempted to bring balance to a council, which they are in the minority. They have not been able to get anything accomplished because they're outnumbered. And it's actually the Republicans, writes King, who are capitalizing on Buddy's death, trying to make it look like the Dems are taking advantage of his passing by raising it every chance they get. What do you think about the division that is apparent that has become even more dramatic over this issue?
You know, and again, I think that the division is there. It's obvious. It's very counterproductive to us as a community from being able to move forward. And I think any time that any side, whether it's Republicans, whether it's Democrats, whether it's black, whether it's white, any time that any of us utilize our, you know, position to, you know, overshadow at the end of the day what's the right thing just because we have the opportunity to do that, I think it's wrong. I think it's very wrong for individuals that may have the majority of the power to say, well, hey, you know what, we don't need your vote because, you know, it's seven of us. And without the consideration of the other individuals, that's a slap in the face. That's frustrating. That's counterproductive. And at the same time, it, you know, because there's an opportunity to say, hey, you know, for a moment, even if it's just 9 months, we got the opportunity to stick it back to you. I think that perception is still kind of the wrong strategy, you know, and it's counterproductive because at the end of the day, it doesn't move us any closer to saying, how do we unify? How do we move this city forward? And the unfortunate thing in all of this is the only people that suffer in that process, in that foolishness, is the people that we swore that we would serve to the best of our ability. So I think at some point we've got to be able to look, in my hope, you know, and I know it's optimistic and all of that, but I really hope that my babies, I have six children, my oldest is 22, my baby's four, and I hope at some point that my children are able to be able to live in a community here in Baton Rouge where they have the opportunity not to have to look at people's color, but let me just look at your heart. You know, that's how I raised my children. And, you know, I'll tell you this. In the magic words of Magnus Wicker, my six-year-old, he went to the park one day, Jim, and he said, you know, Mom, I went to the park. I had a really great time. And, you know, he came back home, and I said, great, baby. I said, well, who are you playing with? And he said, oh, there were some kids at the park. And so I looked at him, and I said, well, you know, what do they look like? And he looked at me like really strange, Jim, and he said, they look human like me, Mom. And at that moment, it was two things. Number one, I realized that I obviously had raised him not to see color because he had no idea what I was talking about. And then at the same time, it realized to me that I still had some growth to go because that shouldn't have even been a question that I needed to ask him. So at that moment, Magnus Wicker taught me a valuable lesson that I'll never forget.
Reverend Anderson writes, just let the person who came in second take the seat. This is a democracy. This should be the policy for all vacancies until the election. I don't know who came in second to Buddy Amoroso in the last election, but that is one possibility. What would happen if, heaven forbid, something were to happen to you? Would you want your spouse to take your seat?
I would. I think that, you know, we forget a lot of times that, and I've realized this, that over the 20 years that I've been in political life, it has not just been me. It's literally been my family, right? So there's not a decision that I make that I don't have a conversation with my husband about. There's not a meeting that I'm at that he's not watching and involved in, and all of that. And so, you know, and I know that Buddy and Denise had the same relationship, because you're one. And if something happened to me, Mike has heard me consistently. You know, before I came on your show, honey, you know, help me process through what I'm going to talk about with Jim and what's important. So he's all involved. And so for me to say, well, it was just me, you know, no, when you're electing somebody, you're electing them as a person, but you also have to recognize that there's a family and a spouse that's attached to them that's just as involved normally. And if something happened to me, I would like the opportunity for my husband to be able to fulfill my unexpired term, because he knows my heart, he knows my goals, he knows what I intended to accomplish, and allow that to be fulfilled until such time that the voters of that district vote for someone else to fill that seat.
Jay on Florida Boulevard. Jay, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Tara Wicker. Hi, Jay.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, Mr. Inkster. Mrs. Wicker, I would like to ask, with your upbringing and the way you say you're raising your children, first, how can you raise them not to be colorblind when there are very distinct differences in color, and people have been treated differently for years because of that reason? With that said, with your stance on this issue, how can you explain the way the Democratic Party has become, for lack of a better term, weak and non-existent?
All right. Your thoughts. Thank you, Jay. Your thoughts, Councilwoman Wicker.
Great question. And I think I have the benefit of having so many children, so I have a lot of lessons for my kids. Kids tend to teach parents things. And so my 22-year-old, you know, I realized a while ago that they had not had the experience of watching Roots, you know, and I had that experience as a very young kid, and I sat down and I watched it, and I remember the significant impact that it had on my life. And so I said, okay, you know, I want my kids to understand this journey. I want them to understand. I sat them all down. I made them watch it. And my daughter at the time, she was probably 18, maybe 17, and she looks at me and she says, Mama, I said, baby, I just want you to understand the struggle. I need you to understand, you know, what people went through and, you know, all the horrific things that happened to African Americans in this country, you know, and I just wanted her to have an understanding. And she looked at me in my eyes and she said, Mama, she said, I get it. She said, I appreciate you sitting down and having me to watch this. She said, I understand it. She said, but I just don't want to be defined by it.
Reginald in South Baton Rouge. Hi, Reginald. You're on with Tara Wicker.
Yes, Jim. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and a question. First of all, I would like to find out, how is it that Ms. Wicker can justify defending a position and going against the other city councilman to defend a position that Buddy took himself? He tried to nominate a white Republican for a black seat.
All right. Thank you, Reginald. Reginald Pitcher, I recognize the voice. Tara?
Yeah, and he's a awesome friend of mine, and I totally respect him. And I think as a minister of the gospel, he truly understands this as I do. You know, as Christians, the Word of God tells us, you know, do unto others as you'll have them to do unto you. The Word of God also tells us, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. So just because someone did something to me doesn't mean that if I have the opportunity to do it back to them that I should. So by virtue of the fact that we're Christians, we're obligated by the Word of God to do what is the right thing, even in the midst of someone doing something wrong to us. So, you know, when if it was wrong when Buddy did it, it's still wrong for us to do it. I just think at the end of the day, we've got to be able to stand on what is the right thing to do, as opposed to, you did it to me, so I'm going to do it to you.
Well, thank you, Tara Wicker. It's been a pleasure, and we will follow this story. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.